So what usually comes first? Is it the music or the lyrics?
Well, when you work with Megan, the melody comes first.
If you want to work with me, you got to be able to write the...
That's her thing.
It's true, and it's... Sometimes I just wish it was the other way, but most of the time when I nail a melody, and it's not just a random melody that I'm driving around in my car or in the shower, which is one of my most inspiring places, believe it or not. I really am thinking about the characters, the situation, what kind of style song, all that sort of stuff.
Right, because what will happen is we'll all get together and talk about, like with Rob Hudnut, you know, we would all sit down. We knew the moment in the script that we had chosen to write the song, and then we'd all spend a lot of time discussing what was happening from different characters' points of view, what the mood of the song should be, and what we needed to do in telling it. And then Megan would go away and find a great melody.
And then Amy has a great thing that she does, and I hope you don't mind me bringing this up, Amy, but it's called a vomit draft.
Oh.
And a vomit draft...
It's better than it sounds.
It's better than it sounds. It has thousands of things in it from... This could be the hook, this could be this, this could be this. And what's great about it is many times some lyrics, ideas, suggestions, even the hook can come from those drafts, which can be, you know, 4 or 5 pages.
Right, so I'll center one of those. And what it really is the unedited creative process. And then hopefully something in there will spark her melodic sense.
Right.
And then we'll go from there. Because usually what happens is that the melody sort of springs fully formed. Well, you know what? It makes it very easy. When someone gives you a melody and you're a lyricist, it's very much a fill-in-the-blanks kind of thing, and it's fun. Sometimes I like the opportunity to create a rhythm with my words.
Right.
But I don't have to do that in every case. And when Megan and I work together... I never get to do that.
Poor Amy.
But it's really joyful for me because her melodies are so great. They dictate so clearly how things are going to be said and in what meter and what style that the words flow really easily.
And in Amy's case, she is really queen of the hook, what we call in songwriting a hook.
Yes.
That's the title of the song. Sometimes it's not even the title, but many times it is.
Usually.
And so she can be on her cell phone sometimes. This is an L.A. story. You know, and I'm on my cell phone on the 405, and she might be on the 101.
Those are freeways for anyone who doesn't live here.
The freeways, right. The west one where I am, and the more east for her. And she'll be like, how about this? How about this? And sometimes it'll just be, I will know exactly when she says it, this is the hook. And it's so clear that that's what the song is. And sometimes I can write, you know, a melody around that hook as well. So it's like a give and take once the process gets started.
It's like a game.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of like, do we need a bridge here? That's a section we call a C-section of music where it goes off somewhere else, and then it literally bridges the last chorus or double chorus to the end. And, like, you know, Amy knows so much about music. She's been such a quick study that she's like, oh, yeah, it needs it. It needs to go somewhere else. But a lot of music is also a feeling.
Well, when you're writing a song, and how much beforehand do you know who's going to be singing it?
You mean the actual artist,
exactly.
Like Martin Short?
Like exactly, like a Martin Short or the Barbie character or that kind of...
In this case, we didn't know till afterwards.
Oh.
Oh, well, Megan, is that true?
Well, sometimes it you know who it's going to be, so you can write sort of to them.
Right. Martin Short was in negotiation for a long time while we were writing. So we had him as a hopeful in our heads, and it's very helpful if you can imagine a particular person singing the song.
Mm-hmm.
It sometimes changes what the song is.
Right.
But as for the Barbie characters, we didn't know till after all the songs were written.
And that was part of the difficult part was casting, because as singers, they have to act, and then they had the double duty of they had to sound like the girl who plays Barbie, Kelly Sheridan, has been playing Barbie in all their movies. So we needed our singers to sound as if they were her.
Her.
So
So that was, it was tricky. We cast from New York, from L.A. I mean, it was really tricky to find them. And they did a great job.
Mm-hmm. So you weren't actually involved in any of the actual casting of the singing voice?
Oh, we were.
Oh, sorry, you were. I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
Yeah, that was another job we had. And in fact, Barbie's international, and she, I think there are 19 different languages, and I got to be the international sort of vocal
producer.
I wouldn't say producer, but I got to cast that in all the languages, and it was really hard to find it in a lot of places.
Mm-hmm.
But you can even tell it doesn't matter the language, the acting, the nuance, like all these characters. So that was also a thrill to work on that as well. We got some amazing work done that way internationally.
And it's always fun to hear your songs in Polish.
Or Japanese, Korean. You know, places like Greece where they don't have the same music scales as us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're getting these auditions and you're like, wow, that's sounding a little different. You know, and you know, they had to work a little harder and we had to find singers who really sang in our scale.
But it just goes to show that the universal popularity of Barbie is only growing.
Yeah.
That they've really hit a chord, so to speak, you know, with young girls all over the world. And that's a great thing to be a part of.
Yeah, I got an email actually yesterday from a very good friend in Paris, and the dolls sing in French, and of course the movie's in French, and they were just, you know, all these great pictures of their little girls with their French Barbies. It's really sweet.
In that case, when you get some of that unusual feedback, have you ever been, like, out and about and suddenly you've heard a child singing your song or something like that?
Oh, it's happening all the time in my son's school.
Oh.
Yes, I have parents coming up to me and telling me that their kids are playing the CD over and over again in their car.
They want to kill you?
All kinds of stuff. People, you know, I have a website and people found me over the internet Taiwan and
right.
all kinds of places saying,
right.
here's a picture of my daughter. She loves this so much. Could you send us the lyrics, you know, for X and Y Z songs?
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really fun that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I get pictures all the time of girls dressed in, you know, the princess outfit.
Yeah.
Or the young Erica is the pauper and, you know, dressed up in all those things. And
mm-hmm.
so you get a lot of really wonderful, wonderful fans that way.
I will say that. There's one really traditional thing about the movie, and that is that the princess is blonde and that the pauper is brunette.
Mm-hmm.
And as a brunette, I have to say, I noticed that.
So did Entertainment Weekly when they reviewed us.
But actually, there's a lot of non-traditional stuff in this movie, thematically, about, you know, girls who aren't just waiting for their prince charmings to come rescue them.
Mm-hmm.
They are their own princess charming. And that was really exciting for us, that we didn't feel like we were part of some old mythology, but that we were creating something new and strong.
Well, that did come out in the lyrics to Free when she mentions the fact that, what was it, that she doesn't want, that she wants to be able to make the choices on her own, essentially.
Yeah,
that's what I noticed right away, that there was sort of a different sensibility when it came to the lyric writing for this.
So good, then we're doing our job.
So how closely did you work with composer Arnie Ross on his?
Megan and Arnie worked.
Yeah,
quite
we worked
together.
Pretty closely. Arnie did the orchestrations, and also did the score. Did a terrific job.
Yeah,
and he was great. He's worked for Mattel a lot before.
But, you know, he was doing a lot of weaving in of some of the themes from the songs in his underscoring.
Yeah, and the score, yeah, that was great.
Right, so it's really, you know, two pieces of the same pie.
Right, right, and yeah, he's a wonderful guy, and he's really a fan of this genre, too, this musical genre, so that was also...
That always helps, and so was Rob Hudnut,
right.
our producer, you know, just... a real big traditional musical theater fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we first met, we found out that we both loved Beauty and the Beast, and that was, I think, the glue.
Right. And I have a dog named Schmankin, And that word comes from the songwriting team with Ashman and Mankin,
mm-hmm.
who wrote Beauty and the Beast and Little Shop of Horrors and a lot of amazing musicals. And so he was like, well, I think we found our team based on that alone. So it's great.
So how do you find a voice for Barbie in this case? Do you go out and is it kind of like a casting call, would you say?
Come
down and sing, and maybe you'll be the next Barbie voice.
They actually had agents in New York and in L.A. too, right, Meg?
Yeah, Maria Strada was one of the people in casting who found one of our Barbies, Melissa Lyons. And then the other Barbie, Julie Stevens, I went to NYU with.
and so she actually was involved in the early demos.
Early stages, demos in my living room.
and then made it all the way up to... to the final.
They really enjoyed her. She really had great acting in the demos. And I think even though they weren't obviously produced the way the final went, that acting really came through. And so they really, really enjoyed. I think, though, she played the other part in the demos.
Yes, she did. But she just has a certain theatricality that came through really clearly. She's got a beautiful, crystal, clear voice.
She plays the princess, yeah.
So, but there were hundreds of people. We went through many, many tapes, audition tapes, and they were all given to us by casting people from a number of cities.
Yeah, and I was actually involved in some of the casting, even on the phone at times, for different people, and help musically, shepherd the vocal production of it as well. So... you had that problem of having to sound like someone who's established herself as the Barbie voice,
right?
And they're girls who are 15 or 16 years old, so you have to sound really young, and then they have to have what we call the Megan range, and my Megan range. And if you can talk to any singers, I sort of push the envelope sometimes on the singers. Giving them like an octave and a third, a major third, it's more of a challenge sometimes to sing our musical theater stuff. Our other stuff, I definitely consciously keep it to an octave and things like that. But something like this that's really soaring, I like to do what the great Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers, who wrote those really big, huge ranges and beautiful music. I'm very drawn to that.
Mm-hmm. So you are inspired by then the musical, The Masters,
I'm completely a fan of Rodgers and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein. Mm-hmm. The dichotomy between the two of them, the two different writing styles mm-hmm. that they had.
And so, and I'm a huge fan of Howard Ashman. May he rest in peace.
Yes.
His stuff on Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast mm-hmm. Were just seminal to my awareness of what musical theater could be in the
mm-hmm.
animated world.
Mm-hmm.
He always said that he wanted people to hear something the fourth time around and still find something new.
Right.
He wasn't just writing for that one shot. So there's layers of depth and enjoyment that you get from his words that I think are very carefully planned.
Right. He was a real visionary. And Mankin's music is just gorgeous.